Lecture 13, Introduction, Professor Philip Carey.
Welcome to part two of our course on great minds in the Western tradition. In part two, we're going to look at two different segments of the Western tradition, beginning with what I'll call the biblical tradition, and proceeding through the biblical tradition to what we call the Middle Ages. The labels themselves are interesting, and I want to talk about those. And to talk about these, we have to talk about the whole shape of the Western tradition and what role these two segments of the Western tradition play. Call them segments, call them parts. What I'd like to do is give you a kind of image that will help conceptualize the whole shape of the Western tradition. Picture the shape of the Western tradition as a body, where you have a right leg and a left leg, which I'll call the biblical tradition and the classical tradition, Jerusalem and Athens, the Judeo-Christian tradition, the classical Greek and Roman traditions. The right leg and the left leg form together into a torso, the Middle Ages, the middle of this body of the Western tradition. And then you have a left arm and a right arm, which I'll suggest can be compared to the Renaissance and the Reformation. And then there's the head, the ratiocinative part, the part that does all that thinking and analyzing. And that's modernity, I'll suggest. Now, any way you describe the Western tradition is in itself a position on the Western tradition. How you should describe the Western tradition is always a matter of controversy. So look critically at this description. Don't believe everything that I tell you just because I'm the professor. But let's think about one pretty standard way of thinking about the Western tradition using this image. The crucial notion that got me started on this image of the body as an image for the Western tradition is the notion that two traditions flow together to form Western thought. And these two traditions are the biblical tradition and the classical tradition. The tradition that comes from ancient Israel, on the one hand, and the tradition that comes from Greece and Rome, on the other. So think of this, the biblical tradition first. I'm comparing it to the right leg, right? Because in many ways, the Judeo-Christian strand of the Western tradition is the right-wing strand. It's in many ways the most conservative, and for much of Western history, for many centuries, Christianity in particular was the source of respectability, the source of much power for much of Western tradition. There was a kind of Christian cultural hegemony for many, many centuries. So for much of Western tradition, Christianity is the right wing, the right leg, yes? But it's also in many ways the strong leg, right? This is a right-handed culture and a right-legged culture. The legs are a motive force, right? And both these legs are needed to drive our culture and move it forward. But the right leg is the stronger one. And this is because of the fact that the right leg is precisely the religious side of Western culture. And religion goes very deep in people's hearts and very deep in society and culture. Much of what drives people in times of trouble, especially in times of trouble, but also in times of prosperity, is religion. Much also of the reforming urge of the Western tradition comes from this strong right leg. Think of how many of the people who were fighting slavery in the American in America in the 19th century were fighting slavery because of Christian convictions. Right? So Christianity is not simply a force for reaction and conservatism. It's also a force for change, precisely because it's rooted so deeply in people's convictions. And it's the sort of conviction that people are willing to go out on a limb for, to stake their life on. Right? It's a religious conviction. People are willing to die for their religion. That makes it very, very powerful. But then let's look at the left leg. Think of the left leg as the leg that stems from Greek and Roman civilization, especially from Greek philosophy, if we're looking at the Western intellectual tradition. Think of all those secular intellectuals, intellectuals that don't have strong religious convictions. There's a lot of them, and they tend to be left-wing, right, quite frankly. There's exceptions to that rule, but by and large, the secular intellectuals are left-wing. Their hero, let's say, is Socrates. Right? The man who's willing to question everything. The man who wants to ask questions about everything. The man who upset all those conservative traditional Athenians by saying, well, what do you mean by virtue? right? All those gentlemanly householders who are used to educating their own sons and because they know what virtue is. Socrates comes to them and says, well, what is virtue? Do you know what that is? Can you tell me? Give me a good answer, and then I'll ask you some questions about it. And the questions are friendly but very critical. So the critical spirit of Western civilization tends to be, certainly not exclusively, but tends to be this sort of left leg phenomenon. The phenomenon of asking questions that are not exactly subversive, but do undermine the sort of things you want to take for granted. Religion is often something that you want to take for granted, especially in most traditional cultures, right? You grow up with a religion, you don't question it. Along comes Socrates, and he teaches you to ask questions. So that's why I'm suggesting you can think of the classical tradition as the left leg. But which leg do you want to stand on? In a sense, I'm happier standing on the right leg, because the left leg is the leg of philosophy. And Plato himself, of course, wanted philosophers to be kings. But do you really want philosophers to run things? Do you really? I worry about that. Being an intellectual myself, I'm not sure I want intellectuals running the show, right? And the right leg is stronger. The right leg goes deeper into the part of ourselves that's prior to our thinking and our questioning, right? And that's a strong part of ourselves, the part of ourselves that's so fundamental that we don't even consider questioning it. It doesn't occur to us to question it, right? That's why I call it the right leg. The left leg is the leg where you're standing and thinking, where do I want to go next? Is this really right? Maybe I should redefine this. Maybe I should think of it differently. The left leg is a little unstable that way. Very creative and critical, but a little unstable. So think of that as the two motive forces of the Western tradition, the left leg, the right leg. You need them both, right? You don't want to let go of either one. Otherwise, you're hopping around like a cripple, right? You're hopping along disabled, profoundly disabled. You want both legs in good working order. At least I do, and most of us in the West do. And that's because the two legs do come together. They join to support what I'll call the torso, the Middle Ages, the era of what can also be called Christendom, the era in which Christianity had that cultural hegemony, starting in the late Roman Empire, round about, say, 300 A.D. We could actually date it from, it's 312, I believe, when Constantine converts to Christianity. He's the Roman Empire. Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire and becomes, at that point, respectable and very quickly very powerful and becomes the dominant form of thought for the next millennia or so. But there's a surprise. When you look at the structure of the Middle Ages and Christendom, and especially the structure of power, you find that that structure can be described in terms that come from Plato, from the Republic. In the Middle Ages, the structure of power was usually described or divided into three parts: the clergy, the nobility, and the commoners. That fits the three classes of Plato's Republic, and more or less explicitly and self-consciously, it was meant to fit those three classes. The clergy are the philosopher kings, those who have contemplated the ultimate truth and now come back down into the cave to teach it to the rest of us. The nobility are the warrior class, those whose job is to fight battles and to protect the rest of us. And the commoners are those who go about buying and selling and eating and drinking and doing ordinary things that ordinary people do and need the guidance of the higher classes to live well. So in Christendom, basically, the philosophers did rule, but they called themselves priests and bishops. But they had imbibed a great deal of the philosophical ideal of the Greek world, especially the contemplative ideal, the ideal of getting out of the cave, the world of darkness, the world of bodily involvement, to see the eternal truth that is beyond bodies, right? That's what the clergy were supposed to be able to do. And many of them wanted to devote full time to it. And those who did, those who got the chance, were called monks, right? They went into monasteries, they spent their time full-time contemplating the eternal truth, using not just Plato and Aristotle, of course, but primarily the Bible. But the whole notion of a contemplation of the truth, of going up there and seeing the truth about God, is very much a Greek notion. So the monks wanted to live what were called the contemplative life, the life of theoria, Aristotle called it, the word from which we get theory, right? This vision, of seeing eternal things. But what ended up happening is they got dragged down back into the cave. So, for instance, the first monk who ever was made pope is Pope Gregory I, or Gregory the Great, as he was called. He did not want to be pope. He thought of being pope as being dragged down from where he wanted to be. He wanted to be up out of the cave where he could contemplate. Instead, he was dragged down where he had to run things. They made him run things. He didn't want to, but he was good at it. This is in the 7th century A.D. This is Italy in a period of chaos. The Lombards are invading, and there's battles all over the place, and there's no central government. The central government's over there in Byzantium and doesn't have much power in Italy. And so the most powerful man in Italy at the time is the Pope. The only man who can organize stuff, the only man who can repair aqueducts and make sure that the harvests come in on time, is the Pope. And so the Pope has to be a good administrator. The Pope has to run things, or else people are going to starve. So they take this very bright and well-organized monk who would rather be contemplating eternal truth and say, you're going to have to run things in Italy, because otherwise we're going to die. So you, run Italy for us. Rule over us. Just what Plato thought you should do with philosopher kings. You get them to contemplate the truth a little bit, then you drag them back in the cave and you make them rule over you. So in many ways, the medieval world is the embodiment of what Plato was suggesting in the Republic. But of course, that's too one-sided, because I've just left out the Bible and Christianity. That's also part of the story, the major part of the story, in fact. So what I'm suggesting is, and this is a common suggestion, that in the thought of the Middle Ages, we've got a synthesis of faith and reason, philosophy and theology, the thinking of the Greeks and the thinking that comes from Israel and the Bible. There are several ways of thinking about this synthesis. You can think of the formula, faith seeks understanding, which is the most popular formula probably for medieval thinkers. You start with faith, that is, you believe what the Bible teaches you, and then you inquire in a more or less Socratic way. You inquire, you ask critical questions, and you try to find out more about the truths of the faith that you began with. That's a key model for the synthesis of faith and reason in the Middle Ages. Another model, a little bit later, in the High Middle Ages, about the time of Thomas Aquinas, is the model of philosophy as the handmaid of theology. Philosophy teaches us to think carefully with concepts. It teaches us logic. And theology, of course, is the discipline whose ultimate goal is the contemplation of God. But as we learn theology, we need to learn things like logic and clear thinking. And we need to learn how to make a good argument. And philosophy is a handmaid who provides that service. That's another possible model. Notice, in this model, philosophy comes first because it's secondary, right? And theology is the crown of all the disciplines. In the other model, faith comes first, and the goal is intellectual understanding. So in that model, faith is first, and the fulfillment of our rational or reasonable nature is second, because it's the culmination. So there's a lot going on as these philosophers in the Middle Ages juggle with faith and reason and think about the various ways that they might go together, right? They're all committed, almost all of them, to integrating faith and reason, but they have different models for how it might be done. All right, now that's the torso. That's going to be something we spend a fair amount of time at in these lectures, in the next few lectures. Let me briefly mention the left arm and the right arm. The left arm is the Renaissance. I'm suggesting that it's a left arm because it owes more to the Greeks and the Romans than to Israel and the Bible. It owes something to both. All of Western culture from about the 3rd, 4th century on owes something to both Israel and the Bible. But the Renaissance can be thought of as a reclaiming and renovation of the classical tradition. It involves, among other things, a new learning about the classical languages, Greek and Latin. Then you can think of the right arm as the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation. We'll be looking at Luther and Calvin in a little while. Those are the great reformers, the two great theological leaders of the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century. That was clearly aimed as a reclaiming and renovation of the biblical tradition, of a going back to the Bible. But those folks, too, owed a great deal to the classical tradition. Just as the Renaissance owed a lot to the Bible, so also the Reformation owed a great deal to the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle, more than perhaps they want to admit. That's actually one of the interesting features, is how much Christians owe to Plato and Aristotle, more perhaps than they want to admit, more certainly than Luther or Calvin would want to admit. And then there's the head, modernity. Modernity is where we are, where we see from, right, where our eyes are. If we want to look at our toes, we have to look from way up here, looking way down there. Now, that means, you see, that when we're studying Plato and Aristotle, we're studying from this distance, right? We're using our scholarship, our modern texts. We're certainly not reading ancient texts. We're reading modern translations, most of us. We're reading texts that are punctuated and have divisions between the words, as opposed to the ancient texts, which have no divisions between the words and no punctuation. We're looking at the ancient world from a great distance, but with amazingly powerful tools. We have good eyes. We have some very powerful scholarship that helps us understand the ancient world. I'll suggest that modernity is a little bit like Christendom secularized. Christendom is that torso, that central feature of Western intellectual tradition that makes the West distinctive from other traditions. I think Christendom is, or the Middle Ages, is what makes us a distinctive tradition. That's a controversial view, but just see what you think. Modernity rests on top of that torso, rests on top of that middle part. Modernity is impossible without the Middle Ages. Modernity is what happens when Christendom gets secularized, when habits of thought that arose from this combination of the classical tradition and the Judeo-Christian tradition then become secularized, right? I think we are still heirs of the Middle Ages. We couldn't be who we are if we weren't. The crucial feature of modernity, it seems to me, at least intellectually, when you view it from the standpoint of the Middle Ages, is that faith and reason no longer look like partners, right? Reason no longer looks like a handmaid to theology. Faith and reason start looking more like antagonists than partners. Reason, when people think about reason and philosophy in the modern world, they think of a challenge to faith rather than a partner to faith. That's typical of the modern world, beginning with, oh, say, Descartes in the 17th century. And we'll see that. We'll see that when we get to those lectures. We'll see reason becomes increasingly critical of faith, and faith comes to look more and more like an escape from reason, or something else than reason, something that needs to be separated from reason, that maybe will tie us to some deep pre-rational truth, some feeling that is prior to reason, or maybe it's mystical, or maybe it's simply irrational. But that split between faith and reason is typical of the modern world. Now, let's say a little bit about the characteristics of this torso, which will be one of our central concerns, and which I'm suggesting is right at the center of the Western tradition, the Middle Ages. It begins in the late Roman Empire. We can mark it with the conversion of Constantine in the beginning of the 4th century AD. It's that place is really that 4th century AD, more than any other century, is when these two traditions really start to come together. And they come together, right? One leg and the other leg come together at the bottom of the torso at a place that is generative and also embarrassing. Right? There's something going on when these two traditions come together that is profoundly fruitful, has much future in it, but is also hard to talk about and even embarrassing to talk about. This is, in fact, my specialty, is talking about what goes on when these two traditions come together. And people are touchy about it. People don't want to admit that Western reason has been so interlaced with Western faith. And also, Christians and Jews often don't want to admit how much their faith has been intertwined with Western reason and Western philosophy. I think they're deeply intertwined, and we're a little embarrassed about it. That intertwining, in fact, was resisted by certain kind of puritanical Christians. Most famous is Tertullian, a church father, that is a Latin Christian writer of the... he died in the 3rd century A.D., who's famous for saying, "What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem?" And the expected answer was nothing. Right? Athens belongs over there with Plato and Aristotle. Jerusalem belongs over here with Christ and Moses, and they have nothing to do with each other. But that, in fact, was a minority opinion among Christian scholars. Christian thinkers from the beginning of this torso I'm talking about, wanted to combine both the story of the God of Israel, and I'm going to suggest that what you have in the Bible above all is a story about a person. They want to take that story and they wanted to see it and understand it in categories that they learned from the Greeks, categories of metaphysics. So there's a combination here of story and metaphysics, or history and metaphysics. The timeless thought of Greek metaphysics, of this thought about true being and true essence, and on the other hand, this story about a God who rescues his people. And most Christian thinkers wanted to see them both together, to use the metaphysical categories to understand the story, but to use the story to show what the true meaning, the concrete meaning of the metaphysics is. So Tertullian himself really was left behind. In fact, Tertullian was an opponent of Plato. He named Plato the source of all the great heresies. He might have been right about some things, but at any rate, he abandoned Plato and went with the Stoics. There's no escaping philosophy if you're in the West. And so he ended up allying himself with Stoic philosophy, and his remark about Athens and Jerusalem was really direct against Plato. But the Stoics, you see, were materialists. They thought that both God and the soul were made of material stuff. They thought God and the soul were both made of a divine fire. And this materialist view of God and the soul is something that the church fathers, the great Christian thinkers that followed him, ended up rejecting. They wanted a non-materialistic view of both God and the soul. And to do that, they went to Plato, to the dualist philosophy of the Phaedo that I gave a lecture on earlier. The church fathers did a number of other things as well. They worked on a non-materialistic account of God and the soul. They worked on an account of God that is distinctively Christian, the view of the Trinity, God the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. To do that, they had to end up stealing more language from the Greek metaphysical tradition. They talked about the Son of God, that's Christ, being of one essence with the Father. That's a piece of metaphysical language that you don't find in the Bible, which the church fathers found useful for defining who God was. Right? So there's this creative combination of Greek thinking and biblical language about God, right? The talk about God, Father, and Son, and Holy Spirit, that's from the Bible. The talk about one essence with the Father is from the Greeks. The basic story is the biblical story. But some of the categories used to understand it, especially the categories used to understand the eternal nature of God, come from the Greeks. After all, the Greeks might have been right about some things. Right? It could be that Plato and Aristotle were right about a few things. They might not have known the biblical God, but they were right about some things. At least that's what most Christian thinkers ended up thinking. So that's sort of, that marks off the torso at one end, at its beginning. At the other end, there's modernity, which you can mark off as this period when there's a rebellion against authority, or a flight from authority, as one book calls it. Modernity wants to escape from religious authority and think for itself. The original meaning of authority, by the way, was a pedagogical meaning rather than a political meaning. Authority belonged to teachers rather than to rulers. So authority meant the authority of, say, a clergyman to tell you what to believe. Whereas the modern view is encapsulated in something that my students say all the time. You can't tell me what to believe. No one can tell me what to believe. Right? Whereas the whole job, of course, of a priest or of a bishop in the Middle Ages was to tell people what to believe. That's what authority meant, is the right of a teacher to tell people what to believe. And faith meant believing what you were told, believing what you were taught. That's why you start with faith and then move to understanding, right? For the great thinkers of the Middle Ages, you're not supposed to stay just believing in authority. You're supposed to learn to understand. But you start by believing what you're taught. You start with faith or authority. For the modern period, much of the Middle Ages looks like a period dominated by religious authority. But it also, I think, looks for many people like the period of the heart. Right? The heart is in here. Many times what we find when we look for some deep inner truth, right, that goes deeper than our thoughts, and deeper than our arguments, deeper than our thinking, right, for a feeling that goes deeper than thoughts, many times what we find when we look for that is something that was already articulated in the Middle Ages. Right? Our heart lies there many times. So the Middle Ages can be thought of as middle in several senses. Right? It's the connector between the ancient world and the modern world. Our access to Plato and Aristotle, as through the Bible, is through this Middle Ages. Otherwise, these books, like Plato and Aristotle and the Bible, are simply things we're looking at from a distance, like looking at someone else's foot. But if we're looking at our own legs, we're looking at it through this connection which makes these books the books that shape us. So the Middle Ages are middle in the sense that they're a connection between the ancient world, both the ancient world of Greece and the ancient world of Israel, and the modern world. It's also the connector, right? If Athens and Jerusalem are in our bloodstream, it's because of this connection through this big torso. It's also middle in the sense that that's where all the bloody organs are, right? All the things that are partly hidden from us, the aspects of our tradition that shape us without us quite recognizing what they are, and which look really ugly when we dissect them. But also the aspect of ourselves that many times we feel most strongly when we stop thinking and just sort of feel with our gut. Much of our guts are medieval, I think. See what you think when we have a chance to talk about the Middle Ages. And so also the Middle Ages are middle in the sense of central. To tell the story of the Middle Ages is to walk down the central corridor of Western thought. Let me walk down that corridor very briefly with you to anticipate what we're going to be doing later. The corridor starts, this central corridor of Western thought, with late antiquity, as I suggested, when Athens and Jerusalem come together, beginning especially with Constantine when he converts to Christianity, and thus Christianity becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. Late antiquity becomes the early Middle Ages, also known as the Dark Ages. There's a reason for that label. Knowledge of Greek was lost in the West. The texts of Aristotle were lost. The texts of Plato, most of them were lost. There were very few people who could read and understand the ancient texts, including very few people who had a sophisticated understanding of the Bible. It was a time of darkness in the sense that it was not a time of great learning and scholarship. That's the Dark Ages, say, about the 5th century A.D., well, let's say the 6th century, up till about the 11th century A.D. You can call those the Dark Ages. At about the beginning of the 12th century, we start with what's typically called the High Middle Ages, sometimes even the Medieval Renaissance. The great texts of the classical world come back to the West through the Muslim civilization, the civilization of Islam, which had conquered much of the Mediterranean world in the 7th century, including all of North Africa, and formed a frontier with the Western world. And Plato and Aristotle and these other ancient texts were kept alive in Byzantium, which is the eastern part of the Roman Empire. From there, it got into the Islamic civilization, got translated into Arabic. From there, it got through North Africa and into Spain, where it once again returned to the West in the form of Arabic translations originally, and then got into the Western bloodstream in the 12th century, and thus stimulated the kind of thinking that was called scholasticism, the kind of thinking we get in Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century is dealing with the full corpus of Aristotle's works for the first time. He's the second generation of thinkers who had the whole corpus of Aristotle available to him. Then in the 14th century, after this High Middle Ages Renaissance, you've got disaster. You've got the Black Plague, the Black Death, which is the plague, the bubonic plague. You've got the Hundred Years' War. You've got war and devastation and a real setback for medieval civilization. So we'll be looking especially at this High Middle Ages, and then we'll go beyond the 14th century and look at the Protestant Reformation. Let's look briefly at things that are not in the central corridor. It's interesting to think what's not part of the story. On one side of the central corridor, I label it the twin brother of the Western tradition, there's the Eastern Christian tradition, the tradition of Eastern Orthodoxy, located in Byzantium, in Constantinople, and then migrates to Russia, for the Russian Orthodox tradition. Then you've got, a little further east, Islam and south, which is on the borders of the Western tradition, becomes important as transmitting the classical heritage in the 12th century. Then you have what I'll call the forgotten older brother, the Jewish people, who are around the whole time during this period we call Christendom, and have quite a different view of Christendom. Christendom is the majority tradition, and Jews always have to figure out what to do about that. And that's always a challenge to Jewish identity, right? The challenge of assimilation on the one hand, or ghettoization on the other, or what alternatives are there between those, right? That's a crucial issue always for Jewish identity, because Christianity has become so central to the Western tradition. And finally, think of what I'll call the silent sister, the women that we don't hear much of in this story. Although there's a fair number of them that are important in the Middle Ages, including important mystics and abbesses, leaders of female monasticism. So that's our shape, our body of the Western tradition, and we need to launch into that next by going to the right foot that much of Western culture stands on, the Hebrew Bible.